once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else fill the walls up with our English stead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And the telephone numbers in here are 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And even though the telephone numbers have not changed, if today is not January 10th, 2015...
it's a rerun.
And you won't get us because time only flows forward in our universe.
Well, that we're aware of.
Well, in our universe.
On a very, very small scale in our universe, it may flow other directions. It's hard to tell.
I have never seen that happen.
In a very, very small scale, at the quantum level, cause and effect can be reversed.
Sure, absolutely. But that may be partially outside of the universe.
Well, we don't know. And
that's right.
The effects are inside the universe, so that's what I'm saying. A very small level.
Yeah, but generally speaking, if you try to call us...
And you can't use a quantum phone to call us, so it doesn't matter.
And you're some point in the future from when we say this, more than a relatively small distance. As a matter of fact, we were just reading a New Scientist magazine, which I would encourage everyone to read.
Yes.
That now really lasts about 2.5 to 3 seconds.
So in our minds, yeah.
Well, no, that's the only now that we know how to measure. So the point is that if you call us, for example, you're actually calling into the past.
Well,
slightly.
This is interesting because we have mentioned in the past that Putin is small-minded.
Right.
We just didn't realize how small, quantum level small-minded, in order to realize that the past treaties are not effect because they're in the future
but
something.
But you can actually change the past just a little bit if you call 773-1400 or 1-866-597-1400, because when you talk to us, there's a little bit of a lag.
Yes, there is.
So,
and if you're talking on a cell phone, there's even a slightly longer lag.
Yeah, but you don't notice it if you're calling us. It's because your brain adapts to it very, very quickly. So there is a time distortion effect that goes on here. It's just not very big by our standards.
Correct, yes.
It's measured in milliseconds, which is like millipedes.
Doesn't get measured in our brain. It's only measured
So
other things.
But if it's a completely different calendar day, odds are...
no matter what kind of phone you're using, you're not going to reach us.
Right. Unless, of course, like you're on a spaceship.
And then it will come in a very garbled fashion.
Yeah. I was trying to get a picture of the Comet Lovejoy. Actually, it's Lovejoy 2014 2Q.
You're letting be known your true nerdisms.
Yes. And I did actually get a very good picture of the comet. It's green, by the way, which proves that green eggs, the universe is made out of green cheese. Or green eggs or something, because the comet is glowing green. The difficulty was that I was looking in the wrong place for it. So it took me several hours to find it. And the reason that I was looking in the wrong place for it is the comet was already in tomorrow, and I was still in today. And what happens is the location of the comet was based on 7 p.m. UCT, which is what we used to call GMT, the time in England. So it was 5 hours before midnight in England in another day. And we're on the other side of that. It gets to be very, very complicated. But suffice to say that 6 hours, at 6 p.m. here, it's already tomorrow on the moon.
Right.
And it was already tomorrow on the comet, so I had to look at tomorrow's location.
Well, this also depends on what time of year it is, because if daylight savings messes that up, at any given time it could be either 6 or 5 hours
different. Right, and that is, by the way, that was shown in a study that came out this week to kill on average 12 people a year in automobile accidents.
Well, there is a law that has recently been it's been submitted for review at the Texas legislature in this session. To not do this whole silliness of moving our clocks around twice a year.
I would love that.
Well, whether or not it happens is another question. I don't even know if it's going to get out of committee. You're talking about your nerdism there. I read through about 80% of the submitted bills so far for the current session.
You should be careful about that. You could damage your brain.
I think I did. I may actually have done something permanent to it. I may forever be running into walls or acting politically. Mm. It's insanity.
I have trouble figuring out who our state representative is. I thought it was Dr. Acock, and it turned out that because the redistricting got disallowed,
it isn't.
It's somebody else, and I don't even know who it is. Anyway, we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Morning, Jeff. Morning, Jake.
Good morning.
As usual, enjoy your program. Got tuned in late this morning. Just got in a few minutes ago. This is going to be a purely financial question. Actually, I'm looking for some advice. A little over a year ago, I took $1 million down to a retirement specialist in Austin and had fiduciary responsibilities and stuff. Well, the S&P for the past year, last I looked, was up about 17%. I got stuck in some annuities I couldn't get out of until it was too late. But I still got about 3/4 in cash and then 4 IRAs.
Well,
hold on just a second. Let me hit the big red alarm button. What kind of annuities are we talking about here?
It ended up with one annuity. It's a fixed annuity.
This was not a fiduciary.
Yeah, whoever you were talking to.
Well, yeah, I realize that's lying to you. Yeah, that was separate, they proposed 3, but we got out of 2 on your advice, as a matter of fact. But we were stuck in one and couldn't get out. But the other 3/4 to $800,000 was sitting in IRAs. I'm thoroughly dissatisfied with them, and I'm thinking about trying to liquidate those 4 IRAs into cash, and then pull that cash out and go either to self-directed IRAs. Or handle the money myself, because I was making a heck of a lot more handling it myself than when I went to these people. What would be the ramifications and the things to consider in trying to liquidate these 4 IRAs into cash and then pulling that out?
If you pull it out.
What would I be looking at there? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay. But when you say pull it out, okay, I don't know what he means, but if you say pull it out, meaning take it out of the IRA and take it into a non-IRA, obviously the tax hit will be horrific.
Yeah, you don't want to take it out of the IRA. You may do self-directed, but
I want to give you some advice here. And it's generic advice. It applies to everybody. The concept of doing it yourself, because you got involved with somebody who is, and I don't know whoever you're talking to, but I can tell you that if they put you in a fixed annuity,
he said that was a separate deal. If it was by the same person, that's not a fiduciary to begin with.
I think I know. There is an organization that called themselves Retirement Specialists down in Austin who claim to be fiduciaries who put you in fixed insurance products. And because of the laws in the state of Texas, they can get away with calling themselves fiduciaries and doing that. But they aren't. And they got big commissions. And they... Yeah, sounds pretty bad, but I want to tell you something. Just because you got involved with somebody who was potentially dishonest and probably incompetent doesn't mean that doing it yourself, unless you understand portfolio theory and have got the education to do it, is going to help you. You did miss the first part of the show, and what we talked about was the fact that market returns in last year, certainly, by the way, the Dow and the S&P weren't up 17%.
No.
The Dow was up like 9?
Well, let me say this separately.
Okay.
The trading range for the S&P 500 in the last 52 weeks is a 17% range. But it's lower now than it was, and you had to get in directly at the bottom, which was not the beginning of the year.
So... there's a lot of people who, for instance, I've looked at some well-allocated, well-balanced portfolios where people got 3 or 4% total return for the year. I've looked at other portfolios where people invested in specifically in May with a real good long-term allocation and had a slight positive return, like a 0.7% for the rest of the year. That's not unusual. Now, if you lost 4%, then that's certainly worth taking a really hard look at. If you got into something that had surrender charges and so on, then you can say this is not a fiduciary. This is a person who is interested in making money for themselves, not for you. You know, they kind of like to make money for you, but making money for themselves and their employer is more important, which is, you know, a good adversarial relationship in a business. My suggestion to you would not be that you try to do it yourself. You have done it yourself recently, and you've done very well, but very frankly, since 2009, since the bottom in 2009, it didn't take a genius to make money in the market. All you had to do is just be there. There's a lot of ways to approach this, and doing it yourself, if you were well-trained. I don't know what you did for a living, but for instance, we have a client who's a rancher, and he's a darn good rancher, and he makes money at ranching. There's absolutely no way in the world I could go out there and make a profit managing his ranch. And the same thing applies when you go to any specialist area, any area where there's a lot of competition, a lot of specialty. What you really need to do, in my opinion, with the amount of money you're talking about, is find an organization, a firm, that is registered with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission, A. B, where the people have educational qualifications that indicate they are competent to manage your stuff.
Not just that, though. Let's say there's a conflict of interest because it sounds like we're describing ourselves. But let's take a step back and say, you should have been educated by these people on what was to be expected and what the goals were based on you. And if your goal is to match the S&P 500, that's not really a real goal. If your goal is to get a certain amount of money at some point so that you can live on it in retirement, or, you know, you set the goals, and then you should have your expectations set to the goals.
Right.
We have clients that absolutely in no way, shape, or form are expecting to beat the S&P 500. Mm-hmm. We also have clients that expect that over a long period of time that they need to beat the S&P 500. So it's not necessarily the advice, and I realize we've just said all these bad things about not being a fiduciary over the folks that you were talking to. Your expectations need to be set by the reality of what you're trying to do, not by what's available, by what somebody else has gotten or whatever. And let me take a step further back and give you the psychology of this. I mentioned this to you on the way here in the car, old Baldy. When we are looking at other people and we see what they're doing, you know, that statement about the grass is always greener on the other side of the fence. We can measure that in brains now. We can look at a functional MRI and watch what's happening as those decisions are being made. And what happens is that we're using parts of the prefrontal cortex and the pleasure center to look at what other people have. And when we look at what we have, it goes through the amygdala first. The amygdala is what puts negative values on things. Not only negative values, but it gives a higher weighting to those negative values. This is why you don't eat the strawberry that's just had the cockroach crawl on it. Even if you really like strawberries, the cockroach outweighs the strawberry. The amygdala puts extra weight on the negatives of your own stuff. Then you look over with your pleasure centers at what other people have, and the weighting is roughly double on the negatives for yourself. So if somebody is just a little bit more than half as good as you, you have a tendency to think that they're doing better than you are. And that's, we can see that happening.
Okay, I need to throw some criteria in here for you. This is my recommendation. Yeah, obviously I'm describing our firm, but also there are other firms, particularly in the Austin area, that do this. You need to find an independent investment advisory firm with people who are educationally qualified to do what they're supposed to be doing. And I'm going to throw one other thing in there that isn't absolutely mandatory, but I would recommend it. Find a firm that has somebody in it who is a member of NAPFA, National Association of Personal Financial Advisors, okay? Now, that's not mandatory because, first off, a person has to have CFP after the name before they get into NAPFA, and that disqualifies a lot of really good people. But what they've done is they have pledged not to have a conflict of interest, and they have been investigated by NAPFA. There's only about 1,500 in the United States people who've done this. But at the very least, an independent investment advisory firm, and by the way, by independent, I mean one that isn't doing something else too. In other words, if a guy says, well, you know, I'm an investment advisor, but I also work for the ABC brokerage firm. Well, no. Go away quickly, because they advertise investment advice as a revenue enhancer, and revenue enhancer means you pay more money. Find a firm with multiple advisors in it, so if one of them has a heart attack, you got somebody to fall back on, with a staff, with years of experience, with educational qualifications that indicate, like Jake's got something like after his name, and you don't understand this, and half the time I don't either. CIMA, mine's CFP. All that means is we're technically qualified to manage money. It doesn't mean we're going to be honest. CFP, above all, is as much a marketing tool. These letters after names are mainly marketing tools, but it means they're at least competent to handle your money. If they're an independent investment advisory firm, not a standalone person, and if they're registered with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission, it means they have at least $100 million. They've been at this a while. They got extra people in there. Your odds of getting good advice go up dramatically. Now, obviously, you could go to one of the major firms. There are huge firms out there that also run mutual funds. But again, they do something else besides give you investment advice. And at $1 million particularly, it is my considered opinion that if you find professionals who have all these qualifications and who have sworn to before a governmental agency that they're not going to rip you off, and I'm going to throw one last caveat in, and remember this one. Make sure they do not have custody of your money.
Yeah.
Madoff met most of those qualifications I just gave you, but he had total custody of the money. They need to have an independent custodian with a really solid background that also does not have a conflict of interest.
Now, what I said earlier about education, before you put the money somewhere, they should be able to tell you what to expect. And I don't mean tell you exactly that the market is going to be down 4% over, you know, with your money. I mean what kind of volatility to expect. And if your goals are to avoid the bumpiness of the market, and it sounds to me like that was one of your goals if you went and got some annuities, those annuities are not designed to be hugely high performing, and there's some all kinds of other problems with that. But generally, people that get into annuities are really looking for the guarantee of loss against loss, and that is only as good as the company that gives the guarantee. But that's generally what I see. If somebody comes in and they say I've got money in these annuities, it's because they don't want to see the market drop drastically. So keep that in mind as you're going forward. First things first, if you were told by these folks that they were fiduciaries and they offered you annuities and then they're not fiduciaries and you're in a bad situation to begin with, let's deal with that first. Next step, how do you move forward? You need to have a plan. You need to have something put together that says this is what I want long term, and it needs to have guidelines in the plan that says whether or not you're meeting your goals and expectations at points along the way. That long-term effect of saying this is what I need to get in order to get where I'm going is something that is vital, because if you're not reaching it, if you're not at those points at those given times, you're in trouble. It means that you either need to put more money in or you need to revise your goals. And this is one of the things, you know, this is part of the reason why I was saying there's a conflict of interest here, is because we meet with our clients regularly to say what's changed in your goals and what's going on with your long-term expectations. Are we meeting them? Is this hitting the spot where it's supposed to, and it does it have a reasonable expectation of getting where you want to go? And it sounds like all of that is missing if you're calling this program after being with somebody for less than a year and having these many questions and this much discouragement in their management. There's some problems.
Yeah, and again, it's something that you should, if you're going to manage this yourself, very frankly, go to some, and I'll just flat say this, there's it's not the only company out there, but it's the one that if I were doing this by myself and I were going to go out there and I say, I'm going to manage this myself, and I've advised people in some cases that's probably what they ought to do.
Right.
And there are things at Vanguard, for example, where you can go through and they will work up a portfolio online for you. And at the very least, you may not have the optimal portfolio when you're done. It may be possible to get better performance by using some other places, but at least at Vanguard, you can be reasonably confident.
You're not being ripped off.
You're not being ripped off, and they're not lying to you.
Right.
Okay?
So there's some other educational material. If you're going to be managing this money yourself, then you need to put some time in to get educated, because you've spent your life earning the money. If you're going to just say, I can do that better myself because I did it, but you don't know why you got better. And by that, I don't mean you chose a good stock or, you know, I mean why, because that's gambling. If you're mm-hmm. doing it based on a lot of research and you say this is a good thing, well, what's that based on? And this is one of those difficult things in neuroscience. There are people, in order to know that you're not good at something, you have to be good enough to know that you're not good at it.
Well, then I must be good enough, because I know I'm not good at
right,
a lot
exactly.
of things. Right.
And it takes the same skills to measure your incompetence as it does to measure competence. And those are skills that you earn and by definition have to be competent in. So what I'm recommending here and what I'm saying isn't that you're incompetent. What I'm saying is that you need to put the time and the effort and the energy in to educating yourself on investing. I would recommend highly reading the book Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman. He won the Nobel Prize in economics. He's a psychologist of all things. And that's the neuroscience. And he goes into the decision-making of what it is that you're trying to do. Then once you're getting the ideas of why you're doing the things, the how do you do the things comes next. You don't start with how. That's like saying, I'm taking a vacation. I'm going to buy an RV. And boy, Scotland's going to be nice, because we're in Texas right now. And that RV, well, on the bridge somewhere, you've got to switch to the left side of the road. And you've got to at least recognize where that is. If you start with why, and then go to where are you going? What is it you're trying to accomplish here? Then go to how. Most people go about that completely the wrong way around. They say, I have money, what do I do with it? Not, why am I doing this and where am I going with it first, and then what do I do with it? So get those things clear in your mind. And then it's easier to educate yourself on the how.
And very frankly, I'm going to tell you something else. I don't know what you're invested in, and I'd have to look at it before I could give you any advice on it. Liquidating because it's down may not be a good reason to liquidate.
Liquidating because it's bad is a good reason. Liquidating because it's down is may or may not be a good reason.
And there are several points. Last year, for instance, if you got in August, the market is below where it was in August. That's just a fact. I mean, it has nothing to do with who put you in what or how you got there from here
actually,
or anything else.
The S&P is not actually below where it was in August. It's slightly above where it was in August.
I'm talking about if you But I'm saying it hit a peak in
August.
He
got in November. It's lower.
Yeah, but there are several points during the year, though. If he got in and there's any expenses in there and he's not invested in can't invest in the S&P. Unless you got into – and by the way, if you want the return of the S&P 500, put all your money in an S&P 500 index fund. Now, I would not recommend that.
I wouldn't either because you're going to get all the volatility of the S&P 500.
So there's just so much complexity in investing. And if I've told a lot of people, I was a stockbroker for a long time, quarter of a century. And one of the things I determined as a stockbroker is that if I were good enough to pick stocks to do really well, I wouldn't be working as a stockbroker. I would be managing a multi-billion dollar mutual fund making several million dollars a year. I can't compete with those people. That's why we use mutual funds, because very frankly, the people who manage the better mutual funds over a long period of time, who make millions of dollars a year, aren't getting paid millions of dollars a year by those fund companies because they're stupid. They're getting paid millions of dollars a year because they turn in good returns. Now, there are exceptions to that, but they're pretty obvious. So it's a matter of figuring out what you want to do, figuring out how to get the best advice on it, and going there. And frankly, in many cases, that means you have to do your homework to figure out who you want to hire to advise you. And then you got to turn it over to them and trust them and pay them to do the job. That's not to say you don't watch. That's not to say you don't ask questions. But some of the things that you mentioned are huge red flags. Anybody who would try to put you into a high commission annuity is interested in making a lot of money for themselves. That's just an unfortunate truth. There's nothing wrong with that if you believe in an adversarial business relationship, and that's where brokers are. But when they claim to be a fiduciary and they're doing the same thing, that's a different issue altogether.
Yeah, that's not kosher. That's not good.
Anyway,
nothing good going on there.
Sorry for your loss, but I would approach this. I would approach getting out of the IRAs with the same caution that we just recommended for approaching getting into them.
Right.
And make sure you know where you're going before you get out, because the market is down for the year. We happen to think at some point it's going to recover and be up. And Murphy's Law being what it is, you'll be out when it does it. And even if you have a mediocre equity investment in your mutual funds or whatever you've got in your IRAs, there's the potential there that it's better than being out. And we have a caller on 773-1400. You are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead. Hello.
Hello.
Yellow, you're on the air.
I've got a hypothetical question for you here.
We'll have a hypothetical answer.
I was wondering if two elderly people, the man takes care of the money and he likes to trade and be active in the market, and then he finds out that he's going to expire in 3 months, and he's got about $800,000 worth of capital gains, and he wants to sell these risky things that he's in and then put them in something that's safe and going to take care of his wife for the rest of his life, her life. When it comes tax time at the end of the year, is she going to have to pay the tax on the capital gains that she inherited from him?
If he liquidates and realizes those capital gains
before he expires,
then his estate tax filing will have to pay it to the IRS. If he simply hangs on to them until he expires, then the cost basis kicks up and the taxes aren't due.
Well, there's some caveats in here, too. We got to throw these in. A lot depends on how the accounts and the investments are held. If they're held in both of their names as a joint position, there is a calculation on which part of it has, it's called a step-up in basis, where the capital gains are not. If he wants to sell this before he passes away, he's going to realize the capital gains and the taxes will be due.
Right.
If If the sale takes place after he passes away, there's a different calculation that happens. So
basically,
in this hypothetical situation, you need to talk to a tax advisor.
Yeah, but the simple answer to your question is if he sells and realizes those gains while he's still alive, the taxes will be due, and either at the end of the year, they're going to be due on an income tax return that is
right.
going to have to be paid.
Yeah.
Okay. And so then the smart thing for him to do then would to leave instructions for his wife what to do with the money after he expires.
Assuming that this isn't extremely risky stuff, if we're talking about something that...
Right, it's not.
Okay, because $800,000, you're talking about, if you're getting that all in 1 year, you're up in at least the 20% capital gains
and
right away.
Let's just hope that whoever this elderly person is has a very competent executor.
He does.
Okay. Who really understands this stuff?
A hypothetical executor who likes to call radio programs.
Could be.
Hypothetically.
Well, we wish you well in your adventure.
Thank you very much.
We're sorry to see the elderly gentleman passing on, but obviously he's done well, and that's good.
Yes. He's doing
Thank
well.
You.
Okay.
Thank you for
Thanks
calling.
Thanks for the call.
Yeah, you can't. Death and taxes.
Yeah. you gotta,
there's only two things certain in life, and it's not death or taxes. It's death
and
taxes.
Yeah.
But
and the end of this, something important to know is that as much as we bemoan and complain the paying of taxes, when you pay taxes, it means you made money.
Yeah. And
that's always a good thing.
It's generally, this is not 100% true, but it's generally a bad idea to take actions prior to a person's death that to transfer funds. For example, there have been cases that I've actually seen where a rancher or farmer has a big chunk of land and he's getting old and
he gives it
to his children. When they go to sell it, the basis in that property, and they have to pay the difference between what it's sold for and the basis, was whatever he paid for it 70 years ago.
Right. And where if he waited till he passed away, that cost basis would be the value at the day of his passing.
Texas has arguably the best probate law in the country, at least one of the best.
Yeah.
And it's relatively simple. It's relatively inexpensive. And the... anyone who tries to convince you that you should avoid probate with all of your assets.
That's way above the call of duty. You don't need to do that so much here.
And it can really mess up estates and actually wind up costing a lot more than it saves. Speaking of costing, KTEM does not operate on a nonprofit basis. And as a result, we have to play commercials so that this show can get
paid for.
Be paid for. It's not really a show. And so we're going to play those commercials, and we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and Jake
McClure
on this Saturday, January 10th, in the year of our Lord, 2015. Back to the future. And the telephone number is near 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
In Colorado, legal pot fails to meet predictions of backers or critics. How about that?
That's nice
Did you
to
read
know.
That?
You had just said the headline, but
okay.
I know the revenue estimates for tax purposes was not quite met, but then neither was the crime or
well,
other
the number.
Stuff.
This is interesting. Since Colorado legalized recreational use of marijuana, the use of marijuana by high school students has fallen from about 13% to about 11%. That was a given.
Yep.
The point is that if it's not forbidden, obviously it's not any fun.
Well, and on top of that, the black market has suffered quite a lot. The person that they were buying it from is probably not selling it to them anymore because there are legal ways of doing it. You can get it for cheaper if you do it legally.
And so, as a matter of fact, the use that all the surveys they've had out there on the use of marijuana have not changed among adults. The difference is the state is getting some revenue from it. Some locales, some municipalities have banned marijuana in their inside of their city limits, but they're having a heck of, they can't do anything to enforce it. But that's at least theoretically one of the reasons the tax revenues have not done so well, is there's only a very limited number of places you can buy it at this
right.
point.
There were quite a lot of places that were not able to open in time and so on, but the as of October, which is the last time I was looking at the numbers, we could actually go back to some other things. About $67 million worth of cannabis was sold legally through medical and recreational use. So $67 million, that's a lot of money when you're paying taxes on that money that would not have been there before. It's not going to pay for the school system in the billions of dollars in Colorado. But as the revenue increases, and it has increased a lot since October, do you have the numbers there?
No, I actually had them, but it's somewhere in one of these articles I've got right here. But the point is that the governor had indicated that they would get $100 million worth of tax revenues, and I think they got, like you said, about $67 million.
That's not tax revenues. That's sales. That's you can't get more than 100% of the sales price.
But he was predicting some really high numbers for tax revenues, and they didn't happen. Although, down the road, it could happen. One of the problems, of course, is that when people want to use marijuana, they go to the doctor and get a prescription, and the medical use marijuana is priced 25% lower. The taxes, because of taxes, the difference in taxation, I think there's a 25% sales tax on recreational use marijuana, and there's just a little or no tax on medical use.
Correct.
And so all you have to do is go to your doctor and get a prescription, and you don't have to pay the tax, which putting a 25% tax on something is probably not a really brilliant idea anyway. But basically, they've got some adjustments to do up in Colorado. By the way, a significant portion of the purchases, you know, when I say the use of marijuana in the state of Colorado hasn't risen,
mm-hmm.
the sales have risen tremendously because the majority of the sales are to people who are coming in from out of state.
Right.
So the majority of people are violating federal law by crossing from one state to another carrying a federal controlled substance.
Or maybe they use it all while they're in Colorado.
I kind of think that they're probably not. But, you know, I think it's like Belarus, as you said.
This is an area.
They're probably taking it home and selling it.
This is an area that is, I'm certainly wanting to talk about this on the economic sense. The cost of incarceration in Colorado is a cost that is not part of those numbers. When you're looking at the number of people that are arrested that are no longer arrested in Colorado and the amount of money it costs to put them into jail for a year or 2 years, if you add those costs that are not being levied against the state anymore to the profit that's coming into the state from the taxation of it, you see a much bigger number, a much nicer number than what's being shown.
There's also, from my perspective, a moral deficiency here. If I were the governor of the state of Colorado, as soon as it became legal to have marijuana in the state of Colorado, I would have pardoned everybody who had a criminal record for simple possession.
Right.
But that's just me. I mean, doing something that is legal today, and it is, you know.
I told you I went through and
read. There's still people in prison, by the way, in Colorado for possession.
Right. I told you that I read through the huge number of bills that have been submitted to the Texas legislature so far for this session. And there's still going to be a lot more submitted all through the session. But these are the ones that are on the state's page right now.
You are obviously not busy enough at work. We gotta work on that, okay?
And one of them is a proposed bill that would, if you have 1 ounce or less of marijuana on your person in the state of Texas and you are found to have that on you, they will issue a citation that's not even a misdemeanor. It's not considered a criminal violation. It is purely civil. and there's a $100 fine. So you can't be arrested for it. That's the bill that's being introduced. It has obviously has not been passed. But this it's interesting to me that this bill has been introduced before any medical marijuana bill has been introduced. Or, and why are the economists talking about this? Because it's silly. The whole concept of what we're doing here, when what we know about marijuana is that, one, it's not addictive. Two, it's you can't overdose from it. Three, obviously we want to regulate it and keep it out of the hands of kids. But what are the negatives to this? And the negatives keep coming back to a lot of misinformation about addictiveness or people going crazy on it or something like that. If you look at the facts, it seems a little bit silly that alcohol is legal when people can overdose from that. It is addictive. It is causing a lot of bad things in our society. I'm not saying it should be illegal. Obviously, it's a good portion of our economy. If people do good with it, they actually do it rationally and responsibly. It's in good shape. But it doesn't make sense. This is a hypocrisy to say that one thing is illegal when it's safer than a legal thing. It's kind of doesn't make sense to me. And we would be making revenue at the state level, a lot of revenue, and we wouldn't be spending anywhere near as much money on the incarceration of people that really haven't done any violent crimes.
Well, I wanted to, as we come to the end of the program, I wanted to, again, say something I had said earlier. Let me give you just a really quick, broad brush of this. Right now, the 52-week return of the Dow Jones Industrial Average is right at 8%.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just say you had a portfolio that was 50%, you're conservative, you had a percent, and somehow you had 50% of the return of the Dow Jones Industrial Average. And you also had some safe, short-term, safe stuff in there that basically got nothing last year. Your return for the 12-month, the trailing 12-month period would be 4% if you didn't have any expenses. But in reality, if you look in a mutual fund, if you look at anything that you do, there's expenses. So if we throw the average mutual fund has a charge of 1.4%, we throw in 1%, you're down to 3%. Now, that is an absurdly oversimplified portfolio. But I just want to say this because we're getting some noise from people. I say noise. We're getting some comments from people who, as I said in the first hour, one of them actually was talking about transferring funds to us, and I said there's lots of reasons you might want to do that, but your return for that particular period of time was not a good reason to do it because simply the caller who said that the Dow or the market got 17% last year, it really didn't. And I realize that there are noises to that effect. For instance, the S&P 500 is up 10.99.
For the year. Yeah, for the year. For that last year.
For the 12 months, it's up 10.99. But if you'd only had half your money in the S&P 500, you'd have gotten 5.
Right. And if you got in at any point other than that year, you could have gotten in closer to the top of the market. You could have gotten in at the bottom of the market. You could have had a 17% return. It's a lot of that has to do with when you were in. Mm-hmm. And if you have a negative return during that time period, well, that really depends on where you were.
Yeah, and if you had – now, the guy who called in who had like a 4% negative return, that needs to be looked at really carefully. There's something a little bit out of whack.
There's a problem there.
But having a very, very low return last year, meaning single digits in your total portfolio, is not right now an indication of a problem. And we're going to see more of this peculiarity jumping up and down as we transition from recovery to expansion. And there's a lot of complexity that we can spend a whole show on that.
Up till now, in the last 5 or 10 years, people have been run by the fear of loss. And now the greed's starting to stick its head up. These are the two sides of the same coin. You don't want to be running your portfolio based on either fear or greed. You want to do it based on a rational definition of what it is you're trying to accomplish and a rational understanding of the risks that you're taking when you do it. Because you can do that. It's not something that has to be in the dark. You should be able to define the risks. You should be able to define the reward. Otherwise, I mean, you wouldn't do anything else in your daily life without knowing what the risks and the rewards were.
Let me give you another example about a piece of reality. Again, I like to read Barron's. Barron's has an index in there called the Barron's 400, which basically is blue chips that they consider to be healthy stocks. And the Barron's 400 52-week return is 4.42. There's no expenses built into that. Only 4%. And Barron's is certainly a reputable place, 100% stock investment. You got a 4.42% return for the year, for 12 months. And so don't get too upset if you got a low return over the last 12 months, because, frankly, that's pretty normal at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Well, in case you're wondering, this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and it's the name of our radio program. It's also the name of an investment advisory firm where Jake and I are the advisors, the principals. And if you would like to contact us off the air, either with comments about the show or anything else, we have a voicemail on the weekend, and we have lots of other ways of contacting us, and there's real human beings during the week. But you can give us a call at 947-1111 locally, or
you can reach us toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, which is thepersonalwealthcoach.com. It's pretty amazing. It's the same name as what we do, or TPWC.com.
But there's a really good reason for calling all these things the same thing. It's kind of like the telephone number 1111.
So you can remember it.
Yeah, so I can remember.
Right.
Okay.
On the webpage, there are, and that's TPWC.com, there's podcasts of this particular program. That'll be coming up on Monday.
Mm-hmm. And if you score too high on the luminosity test, go listen to several of those podcasts and take it again.
Yes, you will lower your IQ dramatically by visiting us and listening to our rattling for how many hundreds of hours
have we done this? Don't even like to think about
it. I've been doing this with you since 1998. And in those,
I did it for a couple of years before that. It's what, 96 did we start this?
You started in 97. So you've been doing this for 17 years. I've been doing this for 16 years.
And what do you
think,
get?
Roughly 2 hours a week for 52.
Radio 1400 KTEM.
Until next week, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.
Texas, KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.